This is the Mike Garrigan Podcast.
Welcome to episode 15 of 24 in the Transitions Podcast series from MikeGarrigan.com. My name is Mike Garrigan. In June of 2016, when I gave my 30 days notice to the world that I was closing Two Egrets, my studio, to the public, our bookings skyrocketed. Two Egrets had been my primary source of income since 2008. This recording studio was an extension of my house. The studio afforded me a way to record my own music, as well as the songs of countless other bands, songwriters, and singers. For most of the month of June, I was pulling 12-hour days, thinking, I should go out of business more often. Before 2009, I worked as a DBA, doing business as, called Smitty's, doing essentially the same thing I did at Two Egrets, except I was working out of a spare bedroom in our house with most of the gear, cables, and equipment spilling out into the living room on most days. And this sprawl brought rise to the need for a dedicated recording space. Over the past 13 years, I've worn many hats as a studio owner, roles that are often played by numerous personnel in a traditional studio environment. Audio engineer was one of those roles. An audio engineer is the person responsible for the technical aspects of a recording. While recording technique is an art in and of itself, this skill set primarily applies physics and math to the laws of electronics and acoustics. Audio engineers find themselves with a unique set of tools to use in specific studio roles. The most important tool an audio engineer has at his disposal is the environment in which he works. The formally constructed conditions constitute the most expensive of the engineer's tools because it involves interest in real property, boutique design, meticulous construction, and specialty acoustic treatments. As a novice engineer, I thought that if I had expensive gear or an expensive soundboard or a particular set of pricey preamps, I would be able to make better recordings. I soon found that I could make a better recording with a dictaphone in a well-tuned room than with a $1 million console in a bedroom. If you've ever seen a good studio room, you may notice that very few right angles compose the space. A typical control room is set up in a trapezoidal shape with the side wall taking, say, an 80-degree angle rather than a straight 90. A tracking room is often at least rectangular and is decorated with diffusion panels, which double as really cool-looking walls. And these two considerations allow sound to reflect naturally, but not so much that it colors one's perception of the sound. Sound-absorbing material treats right-angled walls. On the front and rear walls, Two Egrets has compressed fiberglass panels covered with acoustic fabric. Drop ceilings composed of similarly absorptive materials often hide lighting and mechanical details above the ceiling while offering a cool overhead element. It is possible to set up a passable studio environment by hanging foam or using absorptive, movable paneling, although this approach still produces nodes in the sound spectrum. Nodes appear when either a particular frequency is excessive or deficient when listening to an otherwise neutral source. Here, the solution is either mid-priced room-tuning devices or an over-reliance on headphones for referencing and mixing. A second critical consideration for a studio environment is clean power. At nearly all of the apartments and houses I've lived in and worked out of, when I've connected an expensive preamp to regular consumer-grade power, I gambled as to whether I'd get a random hum, spike, or interference. When we built two egrets, the designer recommended an electric sub-panel along with a specific grounding system that guaranteed clean power. Running the wire was time-consuming, but it has made quite a difference. Imagine spending $6,000 on a vintage unit only to find that it produces an inferior sound because of an intermittent hum. Believe it or not, this happens more often than studio owners would care to admit. A third important environmental aspect a studio should consider is air mechanics. Heating, ventilation, and air conditioning are perhaps the most overlooked issues in studio design. HVAC units are loud and air circulation can be noisy. In terms of soundproofing, the air duct is the studio's Achilles heel. When building two egrets at the last hour, we ran out of cash and sacrificed sealing the air supply. Granted, it doesn't make much of a difference, but when the UPS truck visits at 10:30 a.m. every Monday, I can hear the rumble through the vent in an otherwise essentially soundproof room. Environment gets glossed over in studio discussions. I understand. It's not exciting. It's expensive, and often an artist or new engineer finds himself having to work with the space that he has. Moving forward from an initial setup with a decent workstation, I believe an enterprising engineer would be wise to invest in his recording environment in favor of buying expensive gear. Once the listening room and recording environments are as good as they can be, the next thing to consider is monitoring, or how you listen back to what you've recorded. Accurate monitoring is tricky because the best system depends on having constructed the proper in-wall speaker housing to begin with. Ideally, any studio should have at least one set of full-range speakers mounted into the front wall, and this is the best way to comprehend the full range of what you're hearing. Without a full-range system, you will always be second-guessing the low end of your work. I keep the big speakers on when I'm listening back to tracking sessions with clients, and I keep them on about 25% of the time when I'm mixing. The second set of speakers that a studio should have are known as near-field monitors, and these are smaller, low-mid-range, high-end detail speakers. And for most home studios, running near fields with a subwoofer is the best scenario given a home studio's environment. But this can and often does get the job done. Near fields offer an excellent picture of what's going on in the mid-range of a song, and in a bad room, using near fields at low volume and double-checking the low end with headphones is a safe bet. A good third monitoring unit is literally the worst set of speakers you can find. I find that something resembling a set of computer speakers or a really bad boombox does the job here. Listening to and working in the environment that most of the people who hear your song that you're recording, that's a reliable way to attain a universally good sounding recording. If your tracks sound good on these three systems that I've described, most likely they'll sound good anywhere. The next tool that an audio engineer uses is the signal chain, specifically the preamp. Nowadays, everyone is recording to hard disk. Tape is virtually non-existent. If tape is used, it's for a boutique application or for a specific drum sound. Recording to digital formats initially offered a cold and harsh sound, but over time, the analog to digital conversion has become much more accurate. And the number one consideration for a preamp is its signal-to-noise ratio, which expresses the depth and truth of what you're recording. A preamp with a poor signal-to-noise ratio is often hissy and therefore introduces unnecessary noise into the recording. Personally, I've noticed a massive improvement in the sound of the off-the-shelf digital preamps that ship with basic computer interfaces, you know, the USB, the Thunderbolt or FireWire interfaces. The Pro Tools Quartet with the Apogee converters sounds light years beyond the stock signals I was getting when I first started recording into the computer. I've also used the Focusrite Scarlett series for a while with similarly good results. Some expensive preamps offer a variety of colors and warmths, and these considerations don't really matter if you can't hear them. And it's disheartening when the first question out of a prospective client's mouth is, "What kind of preamps do you have?" as if a certain kind of preamp will mask deficiencies in the writing or the performances. Also, it goes without saying that you should use the best cables that you can afford. If recording is a painting, a microphone is a paintbrush. Having a variety of microphones enables different sonic elements to take different roles in a production. A condenser microphone excels at recording vocals and lower volume acoustic instruments like acoustic guitar or fiddle, and a dynamic microphone works well on loud things like kick drums and guitar amps. A ribbon microphone is my favorite way to capture a loud guitar amp. The funny thing about microphones is that the price doesn't necessarily dictate the quality. I have a few $100 condensers that do a given job better than a $1,000 equivalent. I've done the mic shootout. I know the result. And microphones also are a matter of taste. I've personally enjoyed the affordability of the Karma mics and the Cascade microphones, and I have a mic locker full of these things. I also have a few high-end condensers, like a set of Audix mics for drum overheads and a Neumann for vocals. Having at least one reliable all-purpose condenser microphone is essential. To use a condenser microphone, your preamp must have phantom power. And most preamps have a phantom switch, and this allows the signal to be hotter than a dynamic counterpart. A dynamic microphone is a great second microphone for a mic locker. I like the Shure SM57 for snare drums, guitar cabinets, and scratch vocals. Dynamic mics come in all shapes and sizes, some aiming to capture extreme low frequencies like kick drums and bass cabinets and tom drums. If a dynamic mic is all that you can afford, a good trick is to purchase an inline preamp like a Cloud Lifter, and this boosts the mic's signal, essentially turning it into a quasi-condenser microphone. A ribbon mic isn't as versatile as either a condenser or dynamic mic, but it does something unique that offers a pleasant color to a recording. Ribbons are often dull sounding, but that can be a good tool to naturally mitigate harsh sounding source material. Ribbon mics are great for drum room sounds, for close miking on guitar cabinets, for percussion, and for crooner-style vocals. A word of caution, if you use a ribbon mic, make sure that your phantom power is disengaged on your preamp. Phantom power can pop the ribbon in the mic capsule, and a Cloud Lifter is often also a good tool to use with a ribbon microphone, especially for quiet source material. Equalizers are a valuable tool for tracking and mixing. The more tracks you record, the more instruments compete for the space in the sonic spectrum. It is common, for example, that a flat listening of a 24-track recording will have an excessive amount of 200 hertz build up. By default, this is where many of the fundamental harmonics of instruments start. And an equalizer is going to help reduce frequencies that muddy up a recording, and they can also brighten and balance a recording if used properly. Outboard EQs, that is, equalizers that exist outside of the recording platform within the computer, are helpful for tracking by eliminating bass buildup on close mic sources. They can also mitigate instrument nodes, which are inherent buildups of given frequencies. A tom drum, for example, often has unnecessary 400 to 600 hertz sounds that require a dip there in order for them to sound correct and present. A little bit goes a long way. Mic placement should be the first response to a bad frequency, followed by slight EQ work, and only if you know what you're doing. In-the-box EQs are much more powerful tools. These equalizers are often nearly infinite in number and come in a variety of flavors, styles, and formats. The analog modeling software allows for these coveted, expensive analog EQs to be meticulously modeled and used in a computer application. The mid-range Pultec EQ is one of my favorite sounding equalizers to use in mixdown. It's easy to use and it's almost impossible to mess up. When it comes to conceptualizing EQ, my brain works in five bands. I know some engineers can dissect further, but for me, five is a sufficient number. I dissect any sound I hear at any time into five sections. Lows, low mids, high mids, and highs. Lows are the bass and sub-bass. These frequencies will unduly rattle cheap speakers and make a signal appear hotter than it sounds. Low mids are the muddy frequencies. Mids, just plain mids, are the honk frequencies. High mids are the ouch frequencies. And the highs are the bright and airy frequencies. Thinking of EQ in this way helps me not to get bogged down in numbers and start grabbing tools and pulling out specific numbers, but mainly conceptualizing what those sounds are. But as a starting point, for example, if something sounds excessively honky, I'll pull around 600 and sweep around to find the right spot. Compression was a mystery to me for about 4 years as I worked as a professional audio engineer. It was something that was really hard for me to grasp, and I knew compression sounded good and I could use default settings, but I didn't exactly understand what the different ratios did to a signal. An outboard compressor is indispensable for tracking vocals. Setting it to a 10-to-1 ratio is a light limiter, and allowing no more than 6 decibels of gain reduction produces an immediately usable vocal. As a limiter, a dynamic box strictly disallows a signal above a threshold. As a compressor, a dynamics box loosely allows a signal above a threshold. A 6-to-1 ratio is more strict than, say, a 3-to-1 ratio. Starting out using fast attack and fast release times made the most sense, although for bass nowadays I prefer to compress at 4-to-1 and allow the release to beat in time with the song. Sidechain compression is, I think, the second best way to reduce the S-iness of a track. This is called de-essing. And the best way, in my opinion, to reduce S is to literally pull the S out by hand in a digital workstation. But this can take hours, literally hours, for a 3-minute song. So I've done it. I don't enjoy it, but sometimes you do what you have to do for the success of the production. Like EQ, the in-the-box compressors have opened up a world of differences. An expensive optical compressor like an LA-2A is available in realistic plug-in form and can be inserted in as many instances as your system can handle. A best-of-all-world solution exists for the preamp EQ compression issue in the form of a channel strip. If you've ever recorded with me, you know I record vocals through a vacuum tube Avalon 737 channel strip, which has a preamp, a tube limiter, and tube EQ, which also offers de-essing when you engage the side chaining path. I also strap a distressor on the back of that tool and set that up to emulate the aforementioned LA-2A, and this gives me a great vocal tone that has kept my clients coming back to work with me year after year after year. Here's a song.
Yeah, I was looking for love on a starry night. I was looking for something that I knew I could not find. Yeah, it was my kind of moment. Yeah, I was looking to rock, I was looking to roll. I was looking for someone to move my soul. Yeah, it was my kind of moment. If I sing this song, I'm gonna sing this song for you.
She
start at now. Hey, look what I found tonight.
An audio engineer finds himself in one of many roles. Three hats that I've worn in the audio engineering capacity are the recording engineer, the mixing engineer, and the mastering engineer. And each job has its own intricacies and trade standards. A recording engineer is different from a producer. Although many producers are recording engineers and many recording engineers are producers, producers are more of the big picture vision forces behind a project. The engineers are the people who bring that vision to life through the application of the tools I've mentioned. A good example of the difference between these two roles is with the Red Hot Chili Peppers song Under the Bridge. Rick Rubin acted as the producer for not only that song, but the entire album, Blood Sugar Sex Magik. On the song Under the Bridge, he asked singer Anthony Kiedis to share a personal poem that he wrote about his life and how his life is inextricably linked to the city of Los Angeles. And the band huddled around him and came up with that signature hit, which was a departure for an otherwise raucous band, and the act of encouraging Kiedis to share the poem and have the band write a song about it, that's a production role. Brendan O'Brien acted as the engineer for that project, and he set up the microphones and executed Rubin's vision. Again, the producer comes up with the vision, and the engineer executes the vision. The first rule of recording engineering is that the producer is boss. If the producer asks for tracks to be executed in a particular manner, in a specific number of takes, or with some kind of color, that's the job at hand. That's what you do. No input is required from the engineer. Most of the time, the engineer is acting as producer or vice versa, so hierarchy is usually a non-issue. The second rule of recording engineering is having an intimate knowledge of the gear that you are using on the session. This often involves both using computer skills and applying physics principles. And in terms of computer skills, it is essential for the engineer to understand how the audio station in use works. I know Pro Tools inside and out. Other engineers I've worked with prefer Cubase or Logic Pro, and knowing how the tracks arrive and how to arrange them so that they can be heard is an often overlooked essential skill. When I've engineered projects at studios with analog consoles, I'll take 30 minutes before the session begins to ask the studio owner where the talkback button is and how the board is bust to the recording device and what outboard gear is hardwired and what is not. And this is going to save time for the client who's spending the money. In terms of physics, understanding mic placement, gain structure, and what moves a song is important. Acoustic instruments like acoustic guitar, upright bass, and piano are doozies to record. They require good technique on the part of both the player and the engineer. Vocals can be a challenge, especially if you are recording a particularly harsh singer. In that case, I wouldn't use a condenser, but rather maybe a ribbon or a dynamic microphone. Recording drums is the most fun of all tasks, in my opinion, but it's also the most challenging. There's just a lot going on. A third rule of engineering is that in the digital domain, minus six is zero. What that means is, unlike the analog days when hitting plus six on a tape machine produced a really cool sound, doing so on a digital console or computer is a bad idea. It's a deal breaker. Setting your peaks to reach minus 6 compensates for the occasional near zero performance without having to resort to the clip removers or over compression. The fourth rule that I follow as an engineer, and I've seen this done differently in different scenarios, but for me, I don't use any effects when I'm tracking a band or an artist. And this includes compression and EQ, with the exception of the vocal limiting I mentioned earlier. But especially avoiding things like delay and reverb and modulation effects. And the reason is that this approach allows for the attention to be on the cleanliness and the listenability of the source material. This method also allows for a mix to go faster because everything sounds good right out of the box. You don't have to fix it in the mix if it's tracked properly to begin with. And this does require better singing and better playing and better musicianship from your clients. And they may hate you for it in the moment, but when they hear the finished product, they'll say, "Oh, wow, that sounds really good." And one exception to this is when an effect produces a foundation for a song. A pulsing guitar or a delayed keyboard can be an inspiring backdrop in which to record and capture a song. I rarely allow an artist to perform more than 5 takes of a part. And this allows for focus when editing and also exposes deficiencies in technique without requiring the client to spend too much time and money. If an artist hasn't delivered something in 5 takes, it isn't going to happen, not at all. And most digital workstations offer playlist editing, which allows the engineer to audition the different takes in real time and form a composite or comp track of the performance. On vocals, it's best to keep things natural and use pitch correction like auto-tune sparingly, if at all. Some genres like EDM and modern country require auto-tune to fit in, so sometimes it is genre appropriate to approach a robot-like accuracy. Mixing is the funnest role that I think an audio engineer can have. I've always enjoyed mix days, and virtually every mixing engineer approaches the craft differently, but in general, the most common approach and the approach I use is to build the track from the ground up, starting with the kick drum, the snare, and the bass, and then fill in the overhead and room mics on the drums. And then you fit the bass into the picture, and then you add the vocals, and then you add the rest. It's kind of that simple, and it's very fluid, it's very freeing, and it's, I hesitate to say spiritual, but it's so fun to do. It's my favorite part of the studio process, if you could call it that. If the song is well written and arranged, the contrast between sections will already be present, and sometimes you can accent the contrast greater or add contrast where there is none by varying effects between sections of the song. A technique I use is when listening to the track and just the drum, bass, vocal phase of the mix, I tried different reverbs or delays in the different sections, and transitioning from a slap delay to a quarter note delay is always a winner. So it's very exciting. The thing I look for while constructing a mix is buildup of frequencies. I mentioned this earlier. Until I was familiar with what numbers corresponded to what sounds, I would use a spectrum analyzer to double check what I heard. And a spectrum analyzer is sort of a visual readout of, say, the average volume or the peak volumes of what you're listening to. Some people call it cheating, but it does give some valuable visual information with which you can make decisions about what you're hearing. But I found that pulling out 200 hertz was common, and by the time all the instruments are present in a mix, all the frequencies should be evenly present. And it's common for clients to ask for bass heavier or brighter mixes, in spite of both being plentiful on the tracks. But for me, starting with a flat mix, spectrum-wise, is the best approach for the first mix, and then getting feedback from the people who are paying for it can get the mix sounding to what they want it to be. What I found is, rather than using a spectrum analyzer to balance your mix, I think a better approach is simply to just listen to your first mix in a variety of environments and on a wide selection of speakers. And once I think a mix sounds pretty good on the three studio speaker configurations I have, I'll print a WAV file and listen to it on earbuds while walking around with plenty of traffic and noise, just to see how is this mix translating into the real world. I'll also listen on my consumer-grade home stereo and a few different sets of computer speakers. When doing this, I'll make notes focusing on the five frequency ranges I described earlier. I'll also consider changing any major blemishes that appear in the real world. A breath that's cut off or an edit that pops is a common blunder that sometimes gets overlooked under the microscope of the studio, but then shows up glaringly in the real world. Mix loudness is a troubling modern concern. Personally, I think mixes are far too loud, specifically as a result of having to compete with other artists. Mixes get hyper-compressed so that they sound like the biggest band on a consumer's playlist. Since the mid-90s, we've had a loudness war of attrition that trickles down to the independent artist in such a way that, because of limited resources, the independent artist often ruins the dynamics of his mix in order to sound big up against the artists who have the budget. And that way, money is still a barrier to entry in the mix slash mastering phase of the project. I approach loudness by using what is called serial compression. Here I add gain reduction in a series of stages rather than in one giant step at the end, and the giant step, in my opinion, ends up ruining the mix. Just, it's too much for a single program to handle. Adding a dB or two of gain reduction to each instrument and then adding a little compression to the master out usually does the trick. And in terms of numbers, my target for the master out on mixdown is between minus 1 and minus 2 for the peak, and then the average volume I like for it to be about minus 12 or minus 11, and this allows for some headroom in the mastering phase. Mastering is my least favorite part of the engineering chain, and if mixing is the micro mix, mastering is the macro mix, encompassing a tonal balancing and loudness shaping for the entire project. And here I aim for a similarly flat EQ. I shoot for a peak of minus 0.3, because we're trying to get it up to zero without going over, and an average volume of between minus 10 and minus 8. I am very reluctant to print a master that is louder than minus 8, but I will, and I often do, if the client requests it. I've never mastered an album by myself in a mastering room, and usually mastering studios look more like expensive living rooms than recording studios, and that's because they're designed to send a collection of tracks from the sterile, accurate control room to out into the real world. Mastering engineers use a variety of EQ and compression tools that are often dedicated for mastering, and also they're quite expensive. it's not uncommon for a single EQ unit to clock in at $6,000 to $8,000 per channel. If I'm mastering a project, I use an in-the-box computer application called Ozone 7 by the Isotope Company. This program is a standalone mastering suite that offers common mastering tools all in the same unit. It's great. And my process for mastering is to load in a song into the mastering application, and I examine the EQ. And what I'm looking for at first is for a flat EQ. I'll pull out any excessive low end or some muddy frequencies or any of the harsh frequencies or some troublesome top end issues if they're there. I rarely boost a frequency ever. And I think reducing something that's there is preferable to boosting something that's not there. It took me a long time to reconcile my instinct to just turn up the top to make it sound brighter. There's a better way to do that. And once I've flattened out the EQ a bit, I use a multiband compressor. And this tool will allow me to reduce each band of music by 1 to 2 decibels, and then I'll add a dB, a decibel of sound, to the global output of that stage. And I use Ozone's default 4-band compressor, but several different scenarios exist, as many as you can imagine. And this stage allows for an extra edge of loudness done in serial, as I've described. And after that, I'll add the mastering limiter, which significantly improves the perceived loudness of a track. And this often changes the impact to arrive at that desired loud level. And if things aren't quite there, or they are there, but there's a little bit of harshness to the loudness, I'll add a stage of analog limiting and maybe split the difference between the two. And then next, I'll examine the EQ one last time to make sure that the compression and limiting hasn't boosted or pulled out a given frequency too much. But mastering also has a sequencing component. Usually an artist will have a preferred order to the songs. If not, I'll offer a suggestion for a sequence, just listening for insurance of a variety of keys and tempos and feels throughout the program. I always put a half second of empty space before a track, and I offer a second or two between songs, whatever seems to sound good. Mastering also requires formatting for duplication. Usually this takes the form of a properly printed WAV file in a 16-bit/44.1 sampling rate, ready for upload to a duplication server. Less and less clients require CD masters nowadays in favor of the direct upload. And I should mention that some replication houses and digital distribution networks are now favoring higher resolution files as masters. That's something that is going to be on the horizon. And unfortunately, and unfortunately, it's not something I'm going to be directly dealing with anymore. You know, I've been told by many that I'm a good engineer. When interns and young clients ask me where I went to school to learn engineering, I simply point to the 20 albums I've made on my own in various bands and the row of CDs, over 200 of them, on my rack of albums that I have recorded. I've mixed and I've mastered it. And what I tell them is I've learned this craft by doing. I think the best way to learn the craft of audio engineering is to listen to music, lots and lots and lots of music from all genres. Listen to groundbreaking bellwether records like Sgt. Pepper or Pet Sounds or or My Life in the Bush of Ghosts by Brian Eno and David Byrne. Listen to Bitches Brew by Miles Davis. Listen to Fantastic Planet by Failure. And dissect what's going on with these albums and come to a conclusion to what it is about them that's so important. Research the techniques that the producers and engineers used to create these albums. Internalize them and create your own sounds. After you've listened to music for a few years, I recommend starting with a basic computer recording setup like Logic Pro or Pro Tools and buy a simple dynamic microphone and try to record stuff. If you don't play an instrument or write songs, call up a friend who is a songwriter. Everybody knows someone. And see if he'd let you record him. Probably will. Experiment with mic placement. Try the techniques you've read about. Be creative. The Mike Garrigan Podcast is brought to you by MikeGarrigan.com.